Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There is an apocryphal story about women's rights as they used to be in Iraq. Apparently, there was an international conference in Libya in the 1960s. Delegates from the Islamic version of the Red Cross, the Red Crescent Society, came to Libya from around the world. The team from Iraq was all women, no men at all. Delegates from other nations were astonished. Where are the men, they wanted to know? Well, it was thanks to a mix of socialism and oil money and higher education in the 1960s and 70s that Iraqi women had become political and social leaders in many parts of the country. However, most of those gains were completely lost in the years of ruling by Saddam Hussein, so now the more appropriate question might be, where are the women? Connection listeners, is it possible to even imagine that women will play a key role in redesigning and reconstructing their country? What can the West do that might help? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests today are Sidney Quaran and Lauren Sandler. Sidney is a researcher. Lauren is a New York City-based journalist. They have recently returned from a trip to Iraq, working for the Carr Foundation and focusing specifically on women and culture there. Welcome to the program. It's nice to have you both here.
Thank you.
Now, I don't know who would be the best person to tell me the story of what women are enduring there, but Lauren, would it be you about this woman who you met who had her car? It's carjacking is the problem in Iraq.
Carjacking is an epidemic right now, amongst other epidemics. But Sidney and I spent some time sitting in a darkened living room with a family of about 15 women who rarely leave the house and, of course, used to go out until 2 o'clock in the morning until just before the war. And one of them, a young, spunky, curly-haired woman, was out after the war, actually, with her fiancé driving around in his Toyota RAV4 when they were carjacked. And the carjackers decided that, in addition to the car, they'd like to keep the woman. So they threw the fiancé out of the car and attempted to rape her in the car. She actually got out. She threw her body out of a quickly moving car and has scars up and down her head to prove it now. But what is so interesting about this situation is not just the ease with which men seem to attempt rape in a relatively unpoliced society right now, but when the brother of this woman and her fiancé reported the incident to the police, they were really only interested in the stolen car.
And the police were only interested in the car.
Well, the police and honestly the fiancé as well, who, you know, of course, now is no longer her fiancé. But I think that, you know, one thing that she really wanted to make clear to us is that in Iraq, to many people right now, a Toyota is worth a lot more than a woman's life.
And Sidney, that type of story in any city and country can quickly become urban legend. Is this the type of fear that women both in the city and the country are living with in Iraq now?
Well, there are as many rumors as there are facts going around right now. And the urban legends are everywhere, and it's as much the rumors that are keeping people at home. There are a lot of instances of kidnapping of women. Women don't often report the rape because that will impugn their honor. And it's the honor of the woman and the behavior of the woman that the reputation of a family is predicated on.
So what we're talking about is women who have a high education, had a position in society, had some standing. And these are the women who right now are staying at home in cities like Baghdad. Is that right?
Yeah, and even this woman that Lauren was talking about, you know, even during the war and, you know, just in the aftermath, she was going out. And now she doesn't even want to get close to the windows for fear of being seen, for fear of something happening to her.
Doesn't go by an open window in her house?
No, not at all.
Let's hear from Ren Rahim Franke. She's executive director of the Iraq Foundation, and she was born in Baghdad, left that country back in 1978, and has recently returned. She's joining us on the line from Baghdad. Ren Franke, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi.
When I listen to the stories that Lauren and Sidney are telling me, and I try to imagine what life in Baghdad was like back in the 1970s, I just can't imagine what a contrast it is for you to be back there now, looking at the people there and imagining what it was like 30 years ago. Tell me about the contrast.
Yeah. Well, certainly it was a country with far greater security for women. In other words, not only just for everybody, but particularly for women. And you happened to mention the episode in the 1960s. I would say that the 1960s and the 1970s were actually the decades in which women reached the sort of apogee of their social activism, their participation in public life, and so on. And after the 1970s, there was a decline. Iraqi women certainly replaced men during the Iran-Iraq War in the 80s, but they did not achieve the kind of high status that they achieved in the 60s and 70s. Now, there is one issue, and I've heard the other speakers talk about the rapes, the fear that women live in, and also rightly say that as much of it is urban myth as reality. It only takes one or two incidents, of course, to spread through the city and to frighten everyone. But this is still this is now a country of contradictions. You have a lot of women who are fearful, and yet when university begins, there will be very many women. Almost 50% of the students at Baghdad University are women. I should also tell you that the Baghdad City Council has 6 women on it out of perhaps 20 or a little over 20 members. These women are active. They do go out. They do participate. But there certainly is a pervasive fear.
Ren, let me ask you a question, if I can. You've been in out of Baghdad, out of Iraq for 25 years now. So yes. When you are moving around Baghdad yourself, are you concerned for your own safety?
No, I'm not. Well, I'm concerned for my safety, for being possibly at the wrong place at the wrong time because of bombs and car explosions. But I'm not afraid because I am a woman. There is a fear, there is a danger, but it is not so overwhelming as to stop women from living more or less normal life. Now, keep in mind that nobody is living a normal life in Iraq right now. But I think within some parameters, women are trying to live as normal lives as possible. And women are active. Doctors are going to their clinics. Professors are going to universities. And they're trying to function in the professions that they have been occupying in the past. So, as I say, this is a country of contradictions right now.
Would you say that for women getting involved in the reconstruction of their country or returning to university or simply going back to their jobs or escorting their children to school, would you say that their main concern is with security, or are there also concerns about the tradition and some of the sort of tribal rules or laws coming back into force?
Yeah. Well, unquestionably, the primary concern is security. It is the primary concern for all Iraqis. But over and above that, certainly for women, there is a feeling that the kind of liberalism that existed in the 60s and 70s and perhaps even in the 80s, really began to close, the sort of liberal door began to close against women in the 1990s. And by the way, there were a number of decrees by the regime of Saddam Hussein, such as a decree allowing honor killings in 1991, that began to close the window of opportunity and for freedom for women. So women are much more constrained now than they used to be. But I have to tell you, I have just been, in fact, we participated in an organized a women's conference in a town south of Baghdad for 4 days. And the women who participated were physicians, lawyers, as well as housewives and teachers and so on. There were all kinds. Their desire to play a role in reconstruction, in society, in public life, is overwhelming. They are extremely motivated and driven to recapture a position for women in Iraqi society.
But I hear now, what you're saying is that on one hand there's the desire to participate, on the other hand there are all those obstacles that are allowing them from doing that. Is that reasonable?
You are very right. There are all sorts of obstacles. First of all, the security obstacle, which affects women somewhat more than men. There are also the tradition, a resurgence, I should say, of conservative, tribal, traditional elements in society that are restraining women. And there is also the kind of political process which is going on now, which really has not favored women as much as we were hoping and as much as we would like for women.
What do you mean by that, political protest?
Protest.
I'm sorry.
There is a governing council of 25 individuals, and of those, only three are women. There are 25 ministries. There is only one woman minister amongst them. There was a constitutional committee that was set up, a temporary constitutional committee. Not a single woman was on it. And yet we have thousands and thousands of very capable women lawyers. Recently, in one of the most traditional towns called Najaf, the city council wanted to appoint a woman as a judge. And some of the clerics who are very influential in Najaf said that, no, this is against Islam. Women can be lawyers, but they can't be judges. And the political climate here is such that the clerical opinion carries a lot of weight right now. So there are certainly social and political forces restraining women.
Quick last question for you. Are the choices that you're describing choices that the women in Iraq will be making themselves, or will they only make these choices with the assistance and the support of the West?
Oh, the West is indispensable in this. Indispensable. We live in a paternalistic society. Men are in the tradition of bestowing on women the privileges that women get. Women need to be helped in their empowerment. The West can help empower women. They can help train. They can build the capacities of women. They can build their self-confidence. And they can put some criteria for any interim or future Iraqi government in terms of gender diversity. There ought to be certain measures that an Iraqi government, now or in the future, must meet in terms of allowing women's participation. I think this is very, very important, whether we're talking about the U.S., with UN, or any other international organization.
Ren Franke, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ren Rahim Franke is Executive Director of the Iraq Foundation. A reminder, Connection listeners, my guests in the studio, Lauren Sandler and Sidney Quaran, they are just back from a period of time working in Iraq, studying women's rights and culture in that country as part of work that's being sponsored by the Carr Foundation. And a chance to listen to some of the stories of the people that they met and some of the options or the closed doors that they saw in their time there. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And when you think of just how much power and standing women had in Iraq just 30 years ago, the question that we're posing today is whether or not the women can realistically expect to return to that kind of standing. Once again, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, a chance this hour to talk a little bit about what, if any, thing the West should be doing to get women in Iraq back involved in the running of their country. There are so many reasons for them to want to stay inside that there is a debate right now about whether or not it's Iraqi women themselves or the West that ought to try and make sure that they get once again re-engaged in what's going on in their country. My guest in the studio, Sidney Quaran, she is program officer with the Carr Foundation. She did research on both mass graves and the status of women in Iraq, spent nearly 6 months in and out of that country over the past half year, and Lauren Sandler's also with us. She's a New York City-based journalist who was in Iraq for the past 6 weeks, mostly in Baghdad, returned just a couple of weeks ago, also doing research for the Carr Foundation on women and culture. You've seen her writing in any one of a number of places, the New York Times, Salon, Village Voice, the LA Times, places like that. Let's start, if we can, Sydney, and maybe you can kick this off by just picking up the point that Ren was making about the importance of the U.S. being involved in helping women in Iraq, because that's not a universally held belief that the West has to do this, right?
Well, this is a very seductive idea to many in the U.S. We'd like to go over there and help the women there realize their possibilities or rediscover them, as the case may be, since so many of them were able to achieve high professional positions in the 60s and the 70s. But it's certainly a very controversial idea in Iraq, where they're used to occupations, they're used to people telling them how they should live their lives. And it's really a point on which there's a real sticking point. So I think, 2 days before Akila al-Hashimi was shot, the governing council member, we talked to her.
This is the woman who died as a result of that assassination.
She died five days later.
Right.
Yeah. And she was saying that laws are the infant of culture. And so you should not actually be setting up laws and intervening in the constitutional process, that is, the U.S., the U.K., but instead helping the culture to rediscover itself and not interfering in the political process, and not, for her, pushing the women's agenda farther than the men could tolerate, but pushing it just hard enough. She essentially said that if you put women into positions of power when it wasn't the right time and it wasn't the right place, you would actually be undermining the cause of women for time to come.
And Lauren, Akila al-Hashimi was herself a somewhat controversial figure because she's one of the very few who made that transition from her work with the old Ba'ath Party in the foreign ministry with Tariq Aziz. So when you met her and when you spoke to her, were you suspicious about the kind of advice and perspective that she had, or are you able to kind of set all that aside and say, look, here's a really smart woman with some really smart ideas about what ought to happen in this country and forget all the baggage that came before?
Well, I was very skeptical before I met her, as are many women in Iraq. A lot of women would say to me, well, you know, she's the only woman on the governing council with political experience, so that's good. But, you know, she's one of Tariq Aziz's best friends. So a lot of people would say, we hope that she's a double agent. And I actually think that, you know, it was a little bit more complicated than that. I was surprised when we met her, how disengaged she seemed from the Ba'ath Party and how quick she was to criticize it. I mean, she spoke very, very freely about how humiliating it was for her to be a woman in the foreign ministry when Saddam would not allow female foreign ministers to travel outside the country, and how impossible it was for her to do her job for a very long time. And she was thrilled about the possibility of real change. And it's interesting, you know, Rend was talking about the sort of theme of contradiction in Iraq right now. And that was something that certainly came out in our conversation with Akila. You know, she would talk about the need for change and the need for immediate change, but that immediate change would take time, and the need that, you know, for the West to come in and help out, but that this really needed to be a cultural change that would sort of grow up from the roots of Iraqi culture. And the need to have women involved, but that you have to be very careful about selecting the women who are going to be involved, because right now if a woman fails, then the Iraqi men will say, well, we tried it and it didn't work, so now we know and we can move on. At the same time, you know, Akila is one of the women on the governing council who failed to nominate a single woman to the 200-person constitutional committee.
It's 25.
Yeah. 25. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's interesting. I understand her reasons for saying we have to be very careful right now, but how careful can you be?
Here's the part that I find most fascinating, and that is that you have these unbelievably well-educated, articulate, multilingual women saying, we really want to make these changes, but we can only go so far. We need to figure out how fast we can move so we don't tick off the people who are in charge of the mosque, so we don't annoy the patriarchal leaders of the culture. I mean, in a curious way, that's something that's new for them, because they didn't have to worry about that before, did they? I mean, they were basically told, under these circumstances, in this life, under Saddam Hussein, you go over here.
Well, you always worry about how much you can talk about things. I mean, it's not as though these weren't issues before the war. But now, of course, that there is an ability to talk freely, the question is how freely can you actually talk? For example, there's a woman named Wassan Khalil who's been with the Iraqi Women's League for decades now. She's based in Germany, and that's how she was able to continue work with the Iraqi Women's League, because it was forced underground under Saddam Hussein. And now that it's back in action as the oldest women's league in Iraq, you'd think, oh, okay, they're really in a position to start engaging in conversations about rape, about, you know, women who are forced into prostitution, issues that for sort of the women's rights community in the States are real bread and butter. But these aren't things that can't even be mentioned in their meetings, because they need to make sure that they can work alongside religious groups to make any sort of cultural change. And that's something that really frustrated her. These are decisions that women are making all over the place right now, and they're very delicate and difficult ones.
And I think a lot of the women are aware of the fact that the women who really do stick their necks out also get death threats. I mean, there are various religious militias out there. The Muqtada al-Sadr has the Jaish al-Mahdi, and these things are really trying to enforce tribal and religious norms for women. And it's unclear where the death threat's coming from, but certainly the women who are being the most progressive in their statements are really risking their lives on a daily basis.
Now, speaking of women willing to stick their necks out, we have with us on the line Yanar Mohammed. She's director of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq and editor-in-chief of Al-Musawat newspaper. That's the first woman's newspaper calling for equality between men and women. She's joining us now on the line from Toronto. Hello, Yanar.
Hello, how are you?
Fine. Is it fair to call you one of those women sticking their necks out?
Exactly. That's what I call myself, too.
Now, you're back in Toronto. You've been living in Canada now for most of the last 10 years. Are you planning on going back to Baghdad permanently? What are you thinking?
I was planning to take my family too, but seeing how things are going over there, I think it's only fair to keep my family here and go myself. Because if I want to do the change myself, I shouldn't be risking others' lives. It is nowhere for a family to be right now.
Well, it sounds like it's nowhere for a woman to be right now, too. Is that reasonable or not?
No, it's not. If I'm not there, millions of women their situation is going down the drain because nobody's speaking out for them. Nobody's willing to stick their necks out for them. It's either myself and some radical women, or it's nobody at all.
Now, the three of you know each other, right?
Hi, Yanar.
Hi, Lauren. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Yanar, what about this puzzle over whether or not the push for women's rights needs to come more from the West than from Iraqi women like yourself in that country?
I think that the push should come from a big women's solidarity movement. It would be such it would give us strength in Iraq for our cause that the change for women should be a secular change. We should be talking very openly against political Islam, against those who are pushing us back into the houses. I think the support from women all over the world would be quite helpful, and especially from the West and the U.S.
Well, you know, I actually am wondering about something that I remember we were talking about in Baghdad. It's Lauren here, which is, I remember we had a discussion about sort of top-down culture change in terms of law versus bottom-up culture change in terms of more grassroots work. And I wonder how you think the West plays into that.
The exact role the West should play is to bring or support a constitution that gives at least grants women the right to life. As you remember, Lauren, I told you that under our constitution right now, there are articles that support honor killing, and all the civil law, all in all, gives priority to men. Women are inferior because the civil law is based upon Islamic Sharia. And you know, in Islamic Sharia, a man has the right to marry four women and the right to divorce, and also the legal rights and economic rights are almost half for women. And if you want, I could go into that in detail, But that's where the West should come in. The Constitution should be secular. It should be based upon equality between men and women. And there should be no compromise for the religious parties that are there. There shouldn't be much power given to them, which is the case now in the governing council. As you know,
that's not likely to change, because it is primarily the clerics who are going to decide where the power will rest in community leaders. We've seen that already in the large Shiite community in Baghdad, in Sadr City. So how do you push your notion of equality between men and women without pushing it up the nose of the people who are just going to say no?
If you were in Baghdad since the beginning of the war, and if you were there in the last month, you would notice the big change that happened. I mean, the support that is given to the Shiite clerics. In the beginnings, it was like 40 or 50,000 in their procession, the Shiite procession. But now when you go and they have a demonstration, it's only, I would say, sometimes not even a few thousands. People are beginning to see what it is like living under an Islamic Republic of Iran, which we do not want to see in Iraq. That's the situation. There's a secular base in the big cities, especially in Baghdad, and most of the people I spoke to were very happy to see outspoken people against the Shiite clerics that wanted to take us back to the, not to the Middle Ages, even, I mean, much more aggressive than that.
I have a caller on the line who I think has a question for you. We're going to go to Ashland, Massachusetts. Imran's joining us. Imran, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, you know, being a Muslim living in the West, I think that there's a lot of dialogue that you hear about empowering women, but kind of going back to original kind of Islamic precepts, kind of examples of the Prophet and teachings in Quran and Sunnah that kind of showed and demonstrated that, you know, the Prophet was trying to empower women and enabling women to work, to have property and things like that. And so what I wonder about is there a similar movement that's going on perhaps in Iraq and in other parts of the Muslim world to try to go back to original authority to kind of push for these rights? Because my sense is that...
You mean using the religion argument to support women's equality rather than just sort of caving to the clerics who say they're making the rules?
Exactly. And I think there are writers here like Khalid Abu al-Fadl who writes substantively on this, and I think there's another guy by the name of Safi, who's written a book called Progressive Muslims. And I think these issues, they get talked about here, but I wonder, do they get talked about there? And can that be a way of accommodating the culture without looking like you're trying to impose a Western value system?
Yanar, what about that?
Yeah, I don't think of myself as trying to impose the Western system. I'm just trying to bring about some equality between the sexes. And to put you in the atmosphere in the Arab countries in the last decade, because all nationalist projects have failed, especially with the invasion of Saddam for Kuwait, everybody started to go towards an Islamist alternative as an alternative for pan-Arab projects. So for all Islamist parties, it is excellent to make a propaganda about how Islam is good for women. But if you ask me as a woman who has grown up in that background, I would tell you no, that is not the case. Under Sharia, women are not equal to men, and they are given much less rights. But then again, I tell you there should be freedom of religion and of atheism. And we cannot give the way to religious parties to impose their ideas over all the people in Iraq, especially those of other religions.
Lauren,
you know, sorry, it's, I mean, something that I'm wondering about, you know, I know that you are a staunch secularist, as am I, but it seems that almost no one in Iraq is, and I do wonder if we are looking towards democracy and representative government, how we can think about making some sort of compromise. I mean, there are other places in the world in which you know, Muslims have been able to coexist with a more sort of secular politic. And it does not seem to me at all that there's going to be a complete culture shift away from Islam in Iraq, at least not anytime soon, if ever. And I do wonder how you think about merging these two different ways of looking at the world, and if indeed they need to be so separate.
Well, Lauren, I think that the political formula should not be based on religions. I think there should be a right to equal access to equal rights on the right of citizenship. Just make the elections, let the people elect their candidates, and do not set the political formula as 5 seats for the Kurds and 13 seats for the Shiites and this many seats for Sunnis. Just try to imagine the U.S. with this many seats for Protestants, this many seats for Catholics, and this many seats for Hindus, for Sikhs, for Muslims. What would happen in the future? I don't think it will be any different. It will be a civil war between these factions because each of them thinks he is or she is better than the other. I think there should be equal rights for everybody, and there should be free elections. But what we saw was the other way around. We saw that people were selected according to their religions, their ethnicities, and also there was gender discrimination in there, too. So,
but, you think that the outcome of free elections would be something that has religion as part of its outcome? Because that really is what seems to unify much of the country right now?
Yeah, if that is the result, let it be. Let them come to power and let their institutions work, but they will be monitored by the state to see whether they have human practices or inhuman practices against women, against children. But if it's free elections and they reach to power, let them. Isn't that what freedom is about?
Yanar, when do you go back to Baghdad?
I'm planning to go back in 1 month, but before that, I'll be in New York and also in Washington for the next month.
You're going to be busy. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Yanar Mohammed, director of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq and editor-in-chief of Al Musawat newspaper, the first women's newspaper, calling for equality between men and women. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. A chance to explore a little more after the break about just what the obstacles are that women in Iraq are facing now, with the researcher and the journalist Lauren Sandler and Sidney Quaram, who are with me in the studio. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from...
Support for National...
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, Lauren Sandler, New York City-based journalist, just back from 6 weeks in Iraq, where she was doing research and reporting for the Carr Foundation, or with the support of the Carr Foundation, looking at the situation for women there and culture. Sidney Quaram is also with me. She's a program officer with the Carr Foundation and a researcher on issues like mass graves and the status of women in Iraq. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join our conversation about the status of women in that country. And, Lauren, you were saying during the break that there was a demonstration that Yanar sponsored.
The first time I ever saw Yanar Mohammed was when she was speaking into a microphone in front of where the old statue of Saddam that famously toppled.
Square,
in Fira's Square. Yeah. She was standing in Fira's Square speaking into a megaphone about the issues of violence against women right now, about the preponderance of rape and abduction. And what was so interesting about that demonstration, in addition to, meeting a 10-year-old girl who was attending her first demonstration and sort of feeling that I was attending something that would have been completely impossible several months before, was that most of the women who were there were Western journalists. There were only several Iraqi women, and the people who were Iraqis there were men.
Is that because they didn't know about it, or they would have been afraid to come out and be seen in a political demonstration?
I don't know how many people knew about it, but, the women who I spoke spoke to there certainly said that they felt like they were risking something to come, and they were quite nervous to come. And their feeling was that many other women would be there if it wasn't such a safety issue. But on top of that, I mean, you have to remember that, you know, protest and any sort of organized dissent is something which has not existed in this country for a long time. You have a huge population of, within Iraq, you know, majority of the population is under the age of 35. These are people who did not live in a time without the Ba'athist Party. These are, you know, when you go to a demonstration in the States, you expect to see students, you expect to see, you know, people who organize for a living. These people are not coming out to do things like this because it's not part of the national culture right now. And when you think about formulating some sort of debate, when you think about some sort of public discussion about what Iraq can and should be, it's a very foreign notion to most people there because they have been trained to do quite the opposite.
Let's take a call from Louisville, Kentucky. Rakia is joining us now. Hi, Rakia.
Hello. I enjoyed your show. Thank you. It's a great show.
All right.
What I want to say is that the treatment of women, whether in Iraq or any other Muslim countries, has nothing to do with the Sharia law. The Sharia law is fair and just. This is like men wanting to have control. It is the Prophet, peace be upon him, he empowered women. They were business owners, community leaders, doctors, lawyers, educators. They had more right and more power then than the women are now. So if this is not the teaching of the Prophet, where these men are getting it from, this is more like egotistic men that want to be in control. So the Sharia law is just unfair for men and women.
Your point is, Rakia, that it is the men who are interpreting the law to their own benefit rather than the law itself. Is that
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely, because the Sharia law, the Islamic law, is just and fair. And even the times during the Prophet, you know, women fought in wars. They were the ones that were treating men that come from war injured. And it was the men that were coming for advice to women. And the Prophet has very much was equal his treatment between men and women. Even he was given more power and more responsibilities to women than he was doing to men. So I don't know where you know, all this bad treatment is coming from. This is men who are trying to inflict their power. They want.
Okay, Rakia, let me, if I can, just put that over to Sydney, because in the research that you're doing, you talk about the pressures that are on women, the way that men establish the criteria of what constitutes honor in the family, which goes so far as to suggest that a woman, if a woman is raped, she has brought dishonor on the family. And when you listen to Rakia say, you know, this is not the law, this is the way that the men choose to interpret and then impose their version of the law in their households. Is that what you saw as well?
Well, that's part of it. But the other interesting side to this is it also becomes what the women choose. I was talking to some doctors, young doctors, residents in Nasiriyah, a southern city, while I was consulting for Physicians for Human Rights a couple of months ago. And what was very interesting in talking to them is that just 10 years ago, they considered themselves, you know, Islamic, but fairly secular. And you know, they were just trying to do their studies and everything else. As the sanctions really began to devastate the country, and after going through the Iran-Iraq War and the Gulf War, there was a level of sort of personal devastation that they didn't know how to handle on their own. And a lot of the women began turning to religion in a much more vigorous way. These women in the past 5 years have begun choosing the Ayatollah that they will follow, veiling themselves, and giving over a lot more power in the family to their husbands and their fathers. So this has also been self-selecting to a certain extent.
A sort of voluntary culture of mourning, Lauren, is that a way to look
Absolutely.
At it?
Absolutely. We visited a hospital in Baghdad, and the woman who was in charge of sort of the woman's ward there was covered up. And she was talking to us about the experience of mourning that began with the Iran-Iraq War and has really continued, you know, the death of so many men, the experience of so much poverty. And she pointed to a picture on the wall. of the staff of this unit. And there are about 12 women in this picture, and none of them were covered. And she said, and now look around you. Here we are. And every single woman in the ward was now wearing a hijab, wearing a headscarf. She said, this is what happens when you live through these wars. You look to God in times of mourning. But saying that women have looked to religion for support through this period is, of course, very, very different than saying that women are in favor of honor killings and that women are in favor of the laws that have really codified woman-hating in Iraq over the past decade or so. That really is the product of Saddam Hussein. And, you know, it's not like Saddam Hussein was exactly an Islamic scholar who was going out looking at the specifics of Sharia or talking to his citizens about what Islam meant to them. He used Islam as a form of control. And when he was desperate for control, he decided to initiate what he called a faith campaign, in which he, you know, made it very clear that he was a good Islamic man. He was going to align himself with Islam. And then he used Islam to control people. He, for example, rounded up hundreds of prostitutes and publicly murdered them. And of course, not all of them were prostitutes. One of them, for example, was a doctor who was working towards women's rights. But he called her a prostitute, and therefore she was one of the women who was murdered. All of this was a way to gain favor with some of the more fundamentalist communities and also to just find another way to exert control over the population.
In the tone of your writing, though, that I've read, there's a kind of a frustration that women who have the opportunity to say, let's you know, fix the polygamy law, let's fix the honor law, that they're not, they either can't or they aren't moving as quickly as they might to try and create a kind of legal basis for equality yet.
Well,
is that fair? I mean,
it's fair. I was about to say, you know, you really, it's difficult because I'm coming from, you know, I live in New York. I'm coming from a very different perspective. But then I was thinking about that. And I was thinking, you know, even in New York, even in the States, we don't do a great job with these things. You know, we're still dealing with the same abortion debate. We're still watching things, you know, push towards the religious right. We're still dealing with questions of family law here in much more ideal situations. So the fact that women are not, you know, organizing right now, and they're not galvanizing an enormous amount of support. You know, how can they march down the streets when they don't feel safe in the streets? And how can women, you know, formulate dissent when they've been educated against that?
And one of the interesting things about this is that because of the security situation, it's affecting everybody. It's not just affecting women. But what's critical now is that so many key political decisions are being made in this first six-month window, mm-hmm. the beginnings of the formation of the Constitutional Committee and that sort of thing, and women are not taking part in that, partly because they have not been identified as potential leaders and potential people who can take part in these processes, and partly because they just aren't getting out of the houses and they're not making themselves known as potential leaders.
Let's take a call from Framingham, Massachusetts. David's joining us now. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. How you doing? Great show.
Thanks for calling.
A quick question. I was wondering if your guest can just give a very high-level three bullet points what absolutely, in their mind, based upon their research, has to happen in order to get women where they would like to go.
Do you mean in legal and constitutional terms?
Constitutional. Does it need to be elementary education? Does it? And if those three things don't happen, will it, in their opinion, not happen for women?
Well, I can give one bullet point for sure for the Constitution. There has to be a separation of religion and state. And it's not entirely clear right now what direction the Constitutional Committee is going to go, because the preparatory Constitutional Committee is in the midst of a fierce debate about whether the people who will draft the Constitution will be directly elected by the people, which would favor the Shia South and the Shias in general because they constitute almost 60% of the population, or should be nominated by the Governing Council, which would have a little bit more debate on these issues.
Another thing that Sydney and I have discussed is the creation of institutions. This is not something that, you know, it's the situation for women and improvement of such can't simply be imposed from outside. You need to create institutions where a culture change can organically exist within the country. But that means, you know, creation of a ministry for women's rights, or if it's not going to be a ministry, creation of, you know, organizations that aren't just sort of disparate NGOs having different variations on the same conversation spread throughout the city, but a place in which there is a staff, you know, there's a budget, and there's an organized way to have this discussion.
So I guess the second bullet point would be sort of harnessing the existing institutions to actually have an institutional place for women's issues, whether that be a creation, actually, of a ministry for women's affairs, which, incidentally, they have in Afghanistan, but they didn't create in Iraq, even though they created three new ministries. But also, for example, using the universities and using the other, you know, sort of well-ensconced institutions to begin working on these issues.
Surely, though, the third point has to deal with security. I mean, you've made the point, both of you, that unless and until it's a little bit safer in Baghdad, large NGOs like the UN won't operate there. And an organization like the UN, because of the way it's constructed, can provide a lot of support for some of what we're talking about. Could we make that the third point or no?
Security is an immediate measure, but I actually was thinking, as I so often do in terms of education, you know, there are tremendous existing resources in Iraq right now. There is what was once an incredible university. There is an enormous number of women and men holding doctorates who are incredibly well-read, incredibly articulate, and very, very committed to ideas. And there is great potential for culture change for women, if you can think about it in terms of education, which does not just mean educating the women, as, you know, one NGO has done very effectively in the north. There's a group that has had education programs for young women. 23,000 of them have now been educated about their own legal rights and about different ways to organize and discuss their role as women in the north. But you also need education for men. And you need education for all young Iraqis about how to sort of assimilate ideas that I think they understand on an instinctive level, how to assimilate those ideas into public discourse.
Let me just say thanks to David for that question and ask you both, and I guess fairly briefly because we're short on time, you're both young women. When you look at the circumstances facing the young women in Iraq today, that's a generation that didn't grow up when Ren saw the Enlightenment. Are they ready to go there? Are they eager for that? Did you get a sense of a desire or a passion from among the young people you spoke to?
Most of the passion comes from the older generation. It's very interesting that it's the older generation that's trying to bring the younger women along because they tend to be much more conservative. And it's often the younger generation that is trying to tell their mothers to, you know, you're really out of line there.
You're
really
too outspoken.
You're too loose. You know, you really really should rein yourself in. But what I think a lot of this is pointing to, actually, is the role of men in the society. The men there are quite angry. They've gone through some humiliating defeats, and they're angry because they can't even protect their families now. They can't ensure a steady income. They can't provide basic security so that, you know, their girls are not taken away. So in order to think about the role of women in that society, we really need to be thinking also about the role of men and how to sort of help them regain their dignity.
Well, lots of contradictions. Sydney, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Dick.
Sydney Quorum is a researcher working with the Carr Foundation. Lauren Sandler, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Lauren's a New York-based journalist. Earlier in the program, we talked with Ren Remfranke in Baghdad and Yanar Mohammed, director of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, who's currently in Toronto. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We'll be right back.